The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
God appeared unto him at the oaks of Mamre. And he is sitting at the door of the tent in the heat of the day. What are the questions we need to ask on this verse?
What does it mean when God appears to him?
What does it mean that God appears to him? Vayera means to appear a love to him. God appeared to him. Right? It could also be read, somebody appeared upon him. Right? It could be also translated that way. It is different, and we'll deal with the difference in a moment. But what other questions do you have? Yes, sir.
What he had just been through, why was he sitting in the door in the hottest time of the day? Why wasn't he in bed?
Exactly. Good question. In other words, here's a man, 99 years old, just had a circumcision. You would think he'd go to Bermuda, take a vacation, you know, something Jewish. And what he does is he's sitting at the door of the tent in the heat of the day. Seems to be an inappropriate place for a person to be recuperating. Good question. What other questions?
Why is it the oaks of Mamre?
Excellent question. Right? What's relevant about it's at the oaks of Mamre? Not always when it says God appears to him, it says where. In fact, it rarely tells us where God appears to him. All of a sudden, it tells us where this happened. Excellent question. What other questions you have to ask? Yeah.
Can I go back to number two?
No, I'm sorry. Not yet. Yeah, Jamie?
I wonder what the significance is of him actually sitting at the door of the tent.
Okay, so what's the meaning of the sitting by the door of the tent? Okay, good. What else? Alright, what's the significance of the heat of the day? What about the fact that this portion starts with a pronoun? Why does it say, and God appeared to Abraham? Why does it say to him? For remember, this is the beginning of a new portion, and we would expect for a new portion to have his name. Alright, so the pronoun is interesting. And one more question I think is lurking in this verse.
Why does it say that he raised his eyes animals?
That's after. That, we're not there yet. We're still on verse 1. Well, if God appears to him, what's he doing sitting? I mean, what would you expect to happen when a person gets, you know, some kind of revelation?
Well, he already fell on his face, so he probably better sit down.
It's a good point. The Midrash points out that in fact, whenever Abraham had a revelation, he would fall on his face. And this is the first time he does not fall on his face. Alright? That's what the Midrash points out. It says, and he is sitting. Why is it making a point that he is sitting? God appears to him and he's sitting in contrast to what he did before, which is when he had a revelation, he would fall on his face. Okay? So those are some of the questions. Let's go to verse 2. Visa einav, and he lifts up his eyes, v'yal, and he, behold, v'hinei shlosha anashim nitzavim alav. Behold, three people are standing upon him. Nitzavim is, well, stood by him. V'yar v'yaratz, he saw, v'yaratz, he ran likratam, towards them. Mipetach ha'oel, from the door of the tent, v'shtachavu arza, and he bowed down to the ground, bowed down upon the ground. God before them. All right, what questions do you have? Yeah, all right.
I figure Abraham doesn't have neighbors close by, and there's probably a lot of space around his tent. And he's sitting there, you know, by the door of his tent, and he just looks up, and here are these three men. I mean, do you see them from a distance? Or, you know, like, do they just like, get beamed down to, right beside him?
All right, well, I think your question is more connected to the idea of lifts up his eyes. I mean, it doesn't say, and he saw three men. It says he lifted up his eyes and saw three men. So what's this idea of lifting up one's eyes? Right, when it generally would say, and he saw. All right, go ahead, Daisy.
Why did he bow down to these three men when it seems to us in Jewish religion you don't bow down to the ground to anyone?
That's a good question, but it's not true. People would bow in honor of someone, they say, you know, they would go like that, but you know, it's like, you know, it's not considered bowing down to somebody. It's considered to be welcoming somebody. But it's a good question, but that's the answer. There was no problem with it. I don't understand why you thought there was a problem, but there's no problem.
Has that changed in our day and age that we don't do that now? I'm not quite sure. Was it like a cultural thing back then?
It must have been a cultural thing in those days.
That's
right? I know. Now it's an Oriental custom. They adopted that from us. I don't know. I don't know what to say. Yeah, Danny.
Okay, much like what Eric was saying, I think this comment was the end low. The three men stood beside. Suddenly, just seems like a weird phrase.
Okay. Well, it's weird in English, because I don't know what this low means. And lo and behold. The LO over there has a numerical value of I don't know what. But yeah, I see the English could make it a little... In Hebrew? Why did they put the lo in there? Because of the word hine. Hine means behold. In other words, he lifts up his eyes, he sees and behold three people. Something is, you know, there's more to the fact that he just saw these people. There was something revelatory about it. Okay, and that's a careful reading of it. Yeah, Heather.
So then, I'm going to ask another question because nobody else asked it. Why is he so excited to see these people that they're strangers?
Good question. I mean, he sees these three strangers, and he's just so excited he runs out to greet them. But Shari wants to ask, yes?
If they're standing upon him, why does he run to them?
Exactly. It just said, Nitzavim Alav, which seems to imply that they're standing on him, which obviously couldn't be. Hopefully not. But they're kind of like they beamed me down and they landed on him. No, they obviously were right by him, and yet he runs out towards them. So if they're right by him, then how do you run out towards them? All right. This is a very careful reading of the verse. It's a good question. Yeah.
What did the Lord tell him in his appearance?
Excellent question. This should be really one of the first questions that we would ask. We have this revelation. It says that God appeared to Abraham, and that's it. What did he say? We don't see any communication. This is very remarkable. We've never seen anything like this in the entire Bible, whereby God appears to somebody and then says nothing to them. Right? I mean, we actually do see something a lot later. But this is the first time that you see such an idea whereby the divine is revealed and then there is no communication. Right? And that leads us to another question. What's the other question? He has this revelation of God, and what does he do?
He stops it and runs after
some strangers. Exactly! He stops and runs after some strangers. Right? He runs after these strangers. So what is he doing? What kind of behavior is this? Okay, in other words, lifting up eyes and then seeing or looking and then running out. And then it says, and he saw. It says it twice. He saw three people standing upon him, and he saw and he ran towards them. So there's this double seeing going on. Okay. Nobody's asked the question, how a man at 99 years old after circumcision is able to run.
Yeah.
There is an old tradition that says, ouch. Then there's verse 4. And Viomer Hashem, Viomer Adoni, and he said, Master, Imna matzati chen beinecha, if I found favor in your eyes, Al na tavor mi alav decha, please do not pass by your servant. What's the question that you need to ask in this verse? Well, the question is, who is he talking to? Because the word Adoni, or Adonai, can be referring to God. It can also be referring to a human being. You can speak in a very polite way. It's like saying, sir. Okay? So the question is, who is Avram speaking to? The English is clearly indicating that it's speaking to God. Alright? But that's not clear in the Hebrew. Let's now go back to the beginning. Alright? It says, and Abraham and appeared to him God. Or God appeared to him. And we pointed out that there is no, this is a pronoun. This is, does not say Abraham. What must that indicate to us? If it doesn't use a pronoun. If it does use a pronoun. And does say Abraham. Why? I mean, every other, I mean, this is the beginning of a portion. And yet this beginning starts off with him rather than Avraham.
It's the continuation of the same scene.
Exactly. Alright? Exactly. In other words, it's telling me that this story follows the last story. Now, obviously, it follows it some in a chronological way, right? But it obviously follows it more than just in a chronological way. Because if it doesn't use his name, it means that this is the direct follow-up to what just happened. That's very important. That I need to see this story in the light of the last story. Not only in terms of time, right? But in terms of thematic sequence. Alright, do you follow this? So it just makes sense. Otherwise it would have said his name. Right? So we're going to have to understand that. It says that God appeared to him at Alonai Mamre. So our question was, why is it so specific in Alonai Mamre? So when you got a question like that, you look up in the commentaries or you look in the Midrash. Right back there you can see the Midrash, that burgundy set over there. That's the Midrash Rabbah. That's one of the most central sources of oral tradition. And you can be sure all the commentaries read it too. It says something very interesting. Who is Mamre? Mamre is a friend of Abraham. Abraham had three good friends. One's name was Eshkol, the other guy's name was Aner, and the other one's name was Mamre. These were his friends. All right? Now the old tradition says that when God said to Avraham, I want you to circumcise yourself, Avraham actually said, no way. Right? He said, what? No. Now we're going too far. Right? Because if you circumcise me, if I circumcise me, if we circumcise us, whatever, that is going to make me so different from everybody else. How will I be able to fulfill the universal mission that I've been chosen to do, which is to be a conduit of blessing to mankind when you are making me so different? I mean, it's already, I'm different enough already in my beliefs and my activities over here, but now physically I'm going to be different. And so therefore the oral tradition said that Avram didn't just say yes, but Avram argued. Right? He had a question about it. Right? He had a question about it, but nonetheless he decided he would do it. Even though he decided to do it, he still asked his friends what they thought. You know, and he asked these three friends, what do they think about what he's about to do? And two friends said no, and one friend said yes. Guess which friend said, go for it. Mamre. Right? Mamre said, circumcise yourself. Now, the question is, am I to believe that if Mamre would not have told Avram to circumcise himself, Avram would not have circumcised himself? It doesn't seem reasonable to assume such a thing. That Avram, who we've seen, well, we didn't see enough of him because we really went to the end of the parsha from the beginning to the end, but what little we know about Avram at this point, I think it's unreasonable to assume that Avram would not have gone ahead and circumcised himself unless this friend of his Mamre would have told him to do it. And it's not as if he had two out of three. Okay, either. He had one friend out of three friends who said, do it, and two friends said, don't do it. Alright? So, why would a person ask another person their opinion if it stands to reason that they would have gone ahead and do it anyways? Right? Have you ever asked somebody their opinion even though you know you are pretty firm in what you're going to do? Like your parents? Right? Like sometimes people ask their parents what they think even though in the back of their minds they're going to go ahead and do it no matter what. But they're still going to ask their parents. Why?
Relationship.
Alright, well, let's see how they think. Could be extra validation. But it could also be for their sake. How so? So that they should be a partner in this. So they should participate in this. So they too should have merit in this. And that's exactly what happened here. Why does it say that he had this revelation at the oaks of Mamre? Because Mamre was the one who told Avram to go ahead and do it, and therefore Mamre merited that this revelation happen at the oaks of Mamre. Right? And, although I'm not sure, but I assume that that would mean that one day at the oaks of Mamre, which must have been some kind of, I don't know, country club or some district where Mamre owned the oaks of Mamre, that Mamre himself experienced some kind of elated experience. And it's important to understand that this is, whether it's here or not, but this is a basic idea in Judaism. That once Avram accepts the covenant, right, revelation becomes more available to all human beings in the world. That things change for the world, not just for Abraham. As we learned yesterday, the verse in Yirmiyahu that says, if not for my covenant, the ordinances of heaven and earth I would not establish. Meaning the goal of the world is covenant. God created the world for the sake of covenant. What is covenant? For the sake of creating a context for the purpose of fellowship, oneness, bonding. Okay? And had Avram not accepted the covenant, which is a piece we didn't look at, but it's in the resource sheet I gave yesterday, then the world would have returned to a state of chaos. Right? The whole world was waiting for this moment. The one human being would accept the covenant and thereby fulfill the purpose of the universe. The world was created for the sake of covenant. That's what Judaism claims. Okay? And when Avraham accepts it, the entire world benefits. The entire world continues to exist by virtue of Avraham. And by virtue of all those who maintain the covenant. Okay? Otherwise, there's no reason for there to be a world. And so once he accepts the covenant, the whole world benefits. The whole world benefits. And this is a basic idea in Judaism, that when the world discovers what the Jewish people's acceptance of covenant means in a universal way, the world will push the Jews, right, to fulfill the covenant. Right? And that's an idea in Judaism, that the non-Jewish world themselves have a very, very vested interest in the Jewish people keeping the covenant. Right? And that might be one reason for anti-Semitism in the world. That the world feels we've let them down. Because the world feels that the Jews have a role that they are to play, and that role is important to all people. And that when you blow it, we all suffer from it. Right? And I read an article, I read a phenomenal interview by a rap group. I think it's Public Enemy Number One. There isn't such a rap group. And in this interview, I was shocked. I think it was the lead singer. He's a black fellow who said, they have a lot of anti-Semitism in their songs. And they asked him, do you hate Jews? And this guy said, I don't hate all Jews. He said, I just hate the ones that don't keep the Torah. That's what this man said. Right. He said, I just hate the ones that don't keep the Torah. But there are Jews that keep the word of God and do what they're supposed to do. But they're the ones I hate. So, interesting. Just a proof, but it's an interesting piece to consider that there may be a dynamic in the world whereby the world feels, perhaps, this is a theory I have here, but part of it, I think, there's other reasons for anti-Semitism. I think one reason is that the world is disappointed in the Jews. That they look at the Jewish people and say, hey, you're the ones that were at Sinai. You're the ones that heard the voice. You're the ones that witnessed all these miracles. You're supposed to be the witnesses of God in the world. Where are you? So what are you doing? Anyways, Avram, when he accepts the covenant, he has a revelation. But somehow, that man, Mamre, who is not a Jew, but it was one who recognized that you, Abraham, as a Jew, should do what you have to do. Okay? Well, then he benefited himself from that. And I remember my sister told me a story that when she graduated occupational therapy, in Toronto. So this, the class, the graduating class, was predominantly Jewish. And they were all going to go out and celebrate. So thinking, hey, where do we go? Says, hey, let's go to Pizza Hut, which is, of course, not kosher. And a non-Jew, not a Jew, a non-Jew said, wait a second. Pizza Hut, it's not kosher, right? I mean, Hetty, you eat kosher, right, Hetty? Must have said, well, you know, don't change your plans for me. Don't worry about me. Oh, no, we wouldn't think of it. We wouldn't think of it. No, and all the non-Jews, they said, no, Hetty, where's the kosher pizza? Let's go to a kosher restaurant. It was the Jews who went, a kosher restaurant? It was the non-Jews who said, oh, we've got to go. Hetty, we got to go to a kosher restaurant for Hetty over here. Right? That's the way it goes, you know? Sad, but that's... So, when Avram accepts the covenant, Mamre himself has already benefited. Okay. He's sitting at the door of the tent in the heat of the day. And the question is, what is he doing at the door of the tent in the heat of the day? Why are we told the weather of the day? I mean, we don't always hear about, you know, it's a very unusual revelation. We're told where it happens and we're told the weather. It's a little unusual, and we're told exactly where he's sitting. So, once again, you look at the Midrash, and you see, what is the Midrash? Because obviously, there's something I'm missing here that Jews knew about the story that's not written, but quite known orally. Well, so the oral tradition says, why was it hot? Because God intentionally made it hot. Why did God intentionally make it hot? Because when it's hot, people don't generally travel. Right? And God did not want Avraham to be disturbed by guests. But Avraham... it's quite the opposite. For him, guests are not a disturbance. For him, not having guests is a disturbance. And that's why this man, who just had an operation, what pains him more than the physical pain of the operation is the spiritual pain of not being able to show kindness to another human being. That's what the oral tradition teaches. Okay? And therefore, he's at the door of the tent, the heat of the day, hoping that he'll be able to see some strangers that he can invite into his home. Okay? And especially once we know the Midrash that Avraham had a struggle with circumcision, because he was afraid that circumcision would so remove him from the universal scene, he so much wanted to demonstrate precisely at the moment where he'd been so branded in, with such a particular identity, he so much wanted to demonstrate the universal meaning of that particular identity by going out to three strangers. Do you follow? So he's standing, he's sitting at the door of the tent, waiting, oh, you've all, you know, it hurts me more not to have guests. And so, God sends him guests. That's why he lifts up his hand, his eyes, because we realize something's weird about these guests. You know? They're standing on him, they're away from him. He doesn't realize it, but God sends him these guests because these guests are really angels. Okay? Avram doesn't know that these are angels, he thinks they're human beings. Okay? Of course, the question is, how is it possible that Avram cannot recognize the difference between an angel and a human being? And the answer offered is, in Avram's eyes, every human being is an angel. Right? To him, angels, human beings, what's the difference? Right? Because human beings are simply angels. And so, Avram could not tell the difference between an angel and a human being. Alright. But, nonetheless, he has this revelation of God. And he's sitting at the door of the tent in the heat of the day. And we asked, why is he sitting? When in the last scene, when it said God revealed himself to him and spoke to him, he fell on his face. So once again, we've got a question. Must be something in our tradition that Jews always knew about this story. Well, you know what the old tradition tells us? That until Abraham circumcised himself, he always fell on his face when he had a revelation. Why? Because it was such an overwhelming experience. In fact, not only with Abraham, but we are taught that that was quite common. That was the common experience of a prophet, except for Moses, right? And here we see with Avram also. Whenever a prophet would have a prophetic experience, they would go unconscious. They would feel, the Ramchal explains, their bodies turning inside out. It would be such an overwhelming experience that they would literally fall to their face, and when they would come to, they knew exactly what they heard, and they had no question it was the voice of God. Okay? But Avram, after he entered into covenant with God, he no longer fell on his face. And that only confirms what we've been developing until now. The covenant empowers Avram to enter into such a relationship with God that he was not overwhelmed when he had a revelation of God. Okay? And that's really the goal of Judaism, that a person is not overwhelmed. The goal of Judaism is not to bow before God. The goal of Judaism is to be able to stand before God. The bowing is a preparation, but it's not the goal of Judaism. Right? We bow in order to stand with a sense of dignity in the presence of God, in a relationship with God. And so therefore it says that he was sitting, meaning he did not fall on his face. However, well, why didn't he stand up then? I've explained why he didn't fall on his face. But why did he stand up? Maybe that would be a little bit more appropriate. So there's an oral tradition, very beautiful tradition. It says that when Avram had this revelation of God, he wanted to stand up. And God said to him, don't stand. But rather, you sitting will be a symbol for your children in the future, where they will sit in the courts and I will stand. Now, that's a very strange tradition. What does this mean? In the courts, they will sit, I will stand. Well, this is something I mentioned a little bit yesterday. One of the remarkable things about the Jewish people is their comfortability with God. It's a remarkable thing, and it's a problematic thing too. When I was a kid, my sister had a very, very close Catholic friend. We lived in a very, very Catholic area. It was Italian Catholic until I was maybe 12 years old. My family moved out of this area. But till 12 years old, I went to a secular school, and I and one other guy were the only Jews in the entire school. And my sister's best friend was this Catholic girl, a girl named Gloria. And we still see Gloria sometimes. She comes to the Holy Land, and she's an evangelist, and we sometimes get together. But anyways, so when we were young and good friends, she invited us to her church, which was just down the street from us. So we went. You know, didn't go too much more than, I think, once. And I remember, what I remembered of the church was how quiet it was, right? And how people sit there with such reverence. And when they sang, they would sing. And then when they would sing, they would sing. And that was it. And when the preacher would talk, people would sit and listen. And it was just so quiet. What I remember shocking to me when I was growing up about synagogues is how noisy they are. You know, and how many times the rabbi has to get up and say, please, please. I know one synagogue that I used to go to, and this is when I was already religious. And I don't know how many times this poor rabbi would have to get up in front of this synagogue, which is supposed to be people who are practicing Judaism, supposed to be taking Judaism seriously. And another rabbi would get up, and it's in the middle of prayer, in the middle of the repetition of the 18 benedictions, or in the middle of the reading of the Torah. And the rabbi would get up at his podium, he'd look at the crowd and go, no, no. And I tell you, I said, my gosh, this guy's probably getting $70,000 a year to go, no. I mean, is that his job? It was, to me, very embarrassing that this is what this rabbi had to do. And it was equally shocking when, after a couple of years of being yeshiva, I went back and was visiting home, and I went and visited the shul, and I saw that he had to do the same thing years later. Right? And that very little had changed. So you ask yourself, well, what's going on? You know, what's going on? And I believe that behavior is a sign of greatness and simultaneously a sign of tremendous failure. Right? But certain failures come from certain special places. I think the problem is that Jews have felt comfortable in synagogue. That they have a very comfortable feeling about God. Right? And therefore, that comfortability allows them to do things that are not really right. Right? I mean, when you feel really comfortable with your father, so you say things and you behave in certain ways, right? It's like, You know, when you hear about your kids and they've gone off for Shabbat at someone's home and the parents call you up and say, your kid is so well behaved. It was just a delight having your kid at our home. He's so well behaved. So you wonder, why is my kid more well behaved in a stranger's house than in my house? Well, that would be terrible if my kid was so well behaved in my house, because that would mean he's not as comfortable with me. You know, of course in a stranger's house, he's uncomfortable. So he's going to not be so well, he's going to be well behaved. But when your own environment, you feel really comfortable, so you have a tendency not to be behaved. Of course, we're not encouraging the kid to not be behaved. But it's also a sign of a certain kind of relationship which we do not want to damage either. And we have to find the balance. And it's sad, but it's true that sometimes you can walk into a synagogue and you can be really turned off by how comfortable people feel to talk about fashion and sports and politics and you name it in a synagogue, right? But on the other hand, I think it comes from a very important place that is a certain, let's call it, it's taking advantage of a certain understanding that one has. Now, when God says, you sit and I will stand, it's a remarkable image of God, once again, that the Midrash gives us. That we have this kind of relationship where God's saying, no, you sit, you know, I'll stand. Don't bother, you know, it's like, you just your mama getting on a bus, no, sit, it's okay. You know, it's like, it's a different kind of image than the image that people have of God, which is this very threatening, majestic, with the lightning bolts. It's not that way at all. So he lifts up his eyes and he sees these three strangers. Now, we had a fantastic question. The question was, wait a second. God doesn't say anything. Right? And we pointed out this is the first time that God does not say anything. So the oral tradition once again comes to our side and tells us that God came to visit the sick. Now what is this Midrash really telling me? What does that mean? I mean, I know it said that, but I have to conceptually understand, what does that really mean? What do you mean when you visit the sick? What does it mean when you visit the sick? What kind of meeting is visiting the sick different than any other kind of meeting?
You can give to them and they can't
give
back to you.
Well, not necessarily. They could perhaps give you something also. But when you're visiting the sick, you're coming there just to be with them. Right? You have no particular reason. It's not like you've got some decision you have to make. It's not like there's something you needed to tell them. Right? When you visit the sick, you're there just to be there by their side. Right? That's why visiting the sick is considered to be a very great mitzvah. Because it's the epitome of a pure meeting. Alright? Now I want you to understand, we ask why is this a pronoun? Why is this following circumcision? Because this is the reward of this mitzvah. Which is the first mitzvah. Which is the archetype of all mitzvot. What is the reward of mitzvot? Right? People want to know, what am I going to get? What's the big prize in the sky, right? Well, the reward of mitzvot is the presence of God in your life. And that's absolutely critical to understand. And we learn it from here. Let me read to you what the Ramban says on this parsha. Ramban, great commentary. Now this revelation of the Shekhinah, the Divine Presence, came to Avram as a mark of distinction and honor. Even as it is said in connection with the dedication of the tabernacle, and they, Moses and Aaron, came out and blessed the people, and the glory of the Eternal appeared unto the people. We have another place in Leviticus chapter 9, verse 23, where it says, the glory of the Eternal appeared to the people, and said nothing. Okay? As it was on account of their effort in fulfilling the commandment of building the tabernacle that they merited seeing the Shekhinah, seeing the Divine Presence. Now the revelation of Shekhinah both here and there was not at all for the purpose of charging them with some commandment or to impart some communication. Instead it was the reward for the commandment, which had already been performed. As it says, as for me I shall behold thy face in righteousness, I shall be satisfied when I wake beholding thy likeness. In other words, what does Judaism says the ultimate reward of living a Jewish life, a Torah life? It's living with the sense of God in my life, right? And that's absolutely critical, because if people think that the reward of living Torah means that everything's going to be better now, everything's going to change now, my business is going to succeed, my stocks are going to go up, people are going to treat me nicer,
Not necessarily. Right? Not necessarily. What will change in your life, Judaism says, is not necessarily the quantity of activity, but the quality of life. What does a person get out of celebrating Shabbos? They get Shabbos. Right? They get Shabbos. It's a qualitative difference in a person's life. Right? What is the reward of love? Love. Right? What is the reward of having a relationship with another person? The relationship with another person. What is the reward of a mitzvah? The mitzvah. Right? And that's exactly what it says in our tradition. The reward of a mitzvah is the mitzvah. The opportunity to live a life which is grounded in a relationship with God, the reward of that relationship is that relationship. When a person lives a life with a sense of relationship with God, then the quality of their life is completely different. The clarity of their thinking is completely different. Right? The sensitivities are completely different. And that is the reward. Alright? It's not so mystical. Right? But it's very, very practical. That's what happens. And that is in fact what happens even in the world to come. When we talk about the world to come, what am I going to get in the world to come? You know, what's the big thing in the world to come? You know what the Muslims say you get in the world to come? You get a harem. And I'm sorry, women, that doesn't seem to excite you, but it does excite the men. They're told, the men are told, that, and that's why if you see, hope we'll never have to see, again, when a terrorist does a suicide attack, they're promised that they get the highest, highest level of the world to come. Right? And what is that? And you know that parents celebrate the death of their children. Right? Because if you killed Jews and committed suicide to do it, you get the biggest prize in the sky, and they literally have celebrations. The parents and the kid, the siblings are all celebrating the death of their child and their brother. I know this for a fact. 72 virgin brides. But that's what they believe. In other words, they believe that the world to come is your greatest fantasies of this world. Right? That's how they see it. The greatest fantasies of a male, Muslim I guess, is to have a mansion, to have cars, right? To have a harem. And that's what you're going to get in the world to come. The world to come is your ideal, this world. That's not Judaism. Right? That's not Judaism. Rather, in Judaism, what do you get in the next world? You get the ecstatic experience of feeling close to God. Feeling close to eternity. Feeling one with transcendental reality. That's what you get. Feeling absolutely embraced in love. Eternally. That is what you get. And that is what it says in the Talmud tractate Brachot, page 17. That in the world to come, the righteous are sitting with crowns in their heads, enjoying the splendor of the Shekhinah, the divine presence. That's it. In the world to come, the righteous are sitting with crowns in their heads, and I'm not going to go into why the crown is in their head and not on their head, but it says in their head, and they are just enjoying, they are basking in the light of divinity. And that's exactly what Avram is experiencing right now. After he enters into covenant, and all the mitzvot are a function of covenant, whenever I perform a mitzvah, I am performing the responsibilities derivative in a covenantal lifestyle, right? What do I get for covenant? And every mitzvah is an expression of covenant. I get that sense of divine presence in my life, right? That closeness. And that's what you get in the world to come, and that's what Avram succeeded in getting in this world. God appears to him and says nothing to him. And that is the most ecstatic experience, that God says nothing to him. Because I don't have to say something to you to be next to you. Right? Those are the most precious moments. When you love somebody so much, that we don't need to say something to each other in order to be together. Right? Just the very moment of closeness requires no speech whatsoever. We just simply enjoy each other's presence. And this is what Avram is experiencing right now. And this is what the Rambam explains. what happens in the world to come. They know and grasp the truth of the Holy One, blessed be He. This is the reward. No other reward could be better. This is the goodness. No greater goodness could follow. This is what all the prophets desired. The greatest goodness, Judaism says, a person could achieve in their lives is the knowledge of God. Right? And the knowledge of God is not some philosophical knowledge. When we say to know, just like in the Garden of Eden, man knew his wife, wink, wink, say no more. It's an intimate connection, right? It's an intimate connection. When you know somebody, you have internalized them. That's why to love somebody, you need to know them. And the more you know somebody, the more you love them, because the more you know them, the more you internalize them into your life, right? And so too, in the world to come, we will have such an internal experience of the eternal, right? Such an internal experience of the eternal, that is ecstasy. And Avram succeeded in achieving such an ecstatic experience in this world. But now our question becomes even more shocking. So how did this fellow, in this ecstatic world to come experience, how did he see three strangers? And if he did see three strangers, how could he tear himself away? And that was the other question we asked, right? And now there is a beautiful story told by Martin Buber. Now Martin Buber was not an Orthodox Jew. In fact, as best I know, Martin Buber even married a non-Jew. But Martin Buber is known to be a Jewish thinker. And Martin Buber wrote a book called I Vow. Familiar with it? Interesting book. Interesting book. I want to give you the background of how he came to it. Now, he says this story himself. Martin Buber said that he was very involved with mysticism and meditations and static experiences and that kind of stuff. And one day he was in his home, in his room, in his study. He was meditating. And he was absolutely involved. He was overwhelmed. He was having an ecstatic experience of God. Right? And all of a sudden he hears someone knocking on the door. Well, he just barely hears it. But consistently a person's knocking on the door, and Martin Buber says, maybe he'll go away. And Martin Buber says, oh, okay, what can I do? So he tears himself away from this experience. He goes to the door, he opens the door, and there standing is a stranger. Doesn't know this guy. And the stranger says, Mr. Buber, I'm sorry, could I? But apparently the stranger picked up that it was an awkward moment. You know, I'm sure you've had the experience, you come to someone's house and you get a feeling it was the wrong time, right? So this fellow felt that somehow it was the wrong time. So he said, but Mr. Buber said, please come in, come in. Brought him into the living room, sat him down, says, what is it? Okay, let me, how can I help you? So the fellow tried to communicate what it is that was on his mind, on his heart, and he was having a very hard time. And so he finally said, Mr. Buber, I'm really sorry, but I'll come back another time. No, I'll come back another time. So the fellow left, and Martin Buber went back into his room to come back to his ecstatic experience. About 2 days later, Martin Buber finds out that this guy was killed. Something like that. And he realized that the fellow must have come to him in tremendous distress. And he realized that he wasn't there for this guy. He just really wasn't there for this guy. And this was a very transformative moment in Buber's life. And that's when he developed this whole, or articulated, I don't think it's something he developed, I think he just articulated a basic Jewish principle, which is he developed what he called the I vow. And the distinction between what he called having a God experience versus encountering God. Right? And there's a big difference between having a God experience and encountering God. And this is how he explains it. You see, having a God experience is a selfish experience, like all other forms of having. Right? People like to have lots of things. Some people like to have cars. Some people like to have boyfriend and girlfriends. Some people like to have clothing, money. It's all part of having. Some people like to have spiritual experiences, right? We could call it spiritual materialism, right? Because it's just chalking up spiritual experiences, it's just another form of having. You follow this? A God encounter, however, is completely different. It's a relationship. A God experience is what he calls an I-it experience. A God encounter is an I-thou encounter. There's a sense of I before you. What is the difference? What's the acid test? How do you know you had a God experience or you had a God encounter? How do you know? You know by whether it left you with a profound sense of responsibility. In other words, two people could be sitting in the forest and they're both, you know, in an ecstatic mood. All right? One of them's having a God experience. One entered into a God encounter. Which one? Well, the one that left their garbage. That's the one that probably had the God. Not probably, that's the one that had the God experience. Meaning, I was so involved with myself. This was feeding me. I was feeling great about myself, right? Because I'm having this God experience. And I am not inspired to be responsible. Do you follow this? A person who had a God encounter, not only would they not leave their garbage, they would see all the other garbage and they would pick it up. Because they would feel a sense of responsibility to this forest. Because this is the forest that God has created, and I live in a relationship with God, and therefore if I live in a relationship with God, then I have a responsibility to God. It's a completely different thing. So I want you to know that I have met certain spiritual people who have found to be incredibly arrogant. And yet they're so spiritual. Right? And yet they're so arrogant. And you say, what's going on? And I've met people who pride themselves on meditation and on breathing exercises and disciplines and on the tremendous discipline they have in terms of the way they eat. And yet they don't relate to people like they should. They're so involved in their experience and their self-acclaimed holiness that they don't know how to help other people. Right? What to do for other people. And it's very, very sad. What's sad about it is that they think they are on a high level. And it's better you know you're not. Because if you know you're not, then maybe you'll aspire to becoming on a high level. But when you think you're on a high level, because you've utilized very spiritual practices, not to make you into a responsible being, to make you into another kind of selfish being, right? It's very bad. Very, very bad. And I have to tell you, it happens also in the Jewish world. I don't know if I told you a story. I'm sure I did at one point. But when I visited once a yeshiva, when I first got to Israel, about a month after I was here, I went to visit a friend who was at another yeshiva. I was in a yeshiva and he was in a yeshiva. I was not in a Baal Tshuva yeshiva. And that's another story why. But this friend of mine did go to this Baal Tshuva yeshiva, which is for people who are newly involved in Judaism. Alright, so what happened was, I came, I went into the dorm, guy walks up to me and he says to me, hi, I'm glad you'll be staying with us, this is where your bed's going to be, you know, in the dorm. And he said, did you bring your Negel Wasser cup? Right? And I said, my what? And he said, your Negel Wasser cup. Now, according to, you know, the Torah, when you wake up in the morning, you're supposed to wash your hands immediately. So by your bed is this basin with a plastic cup and you wash your hands. And I said, you know, no, I didn't. And now, of course, I feel really stupid, right, that I didn't. He says, oh, okay, fine. So he goes underneath the bed of some guy and he gives me this guy's Negel Wasser cup, which is, means that, you know, the fingernail cup for washing your nails or washing your fingers in the morning. Okay. Another guy comes up to me and says, what are you doing? What are you doing? He said, well, this guy came without his Negel Wasser cup. Now he's embarrassed me in public, right? And so I gave him Shmuel's Negel Wasser cup. So the guy says, are you an idiot? Did you ask permission from Shmuel? Do you know that that's stealing?
He says, that's not stealing. You're crazy. Why, get your nubs out of this, right? This guy doesn't have a Nagavasa cup. He's going to wake up with impurity all over his fingers. I don't want that all over our dorm. I mean, you know. And the guy says, well, you nuts. You have to ask his permission. He says, who are you? And these guys literally start yelling at each other. The whole time I'm saying, hey, I can wash my hands in the basin. It's okay, though. And the next day we were in a class, and the rabbi was talking about how the ways of Torah are very pleasant. And I was thinking, I was chuckling inside, like, yeah, real pleasant. Look at these two jerks who are fighting over a Nagavasa cup. But one guy in the class had the guts to say to the rabbi, I want to ask you a question, you know. I've been in the dorm, and I saw some things that really turned me off, that were not pleasant. Guys who, in the name of Torah, did some very unpleasant things. How do you explain that, Rabbi? And so the rabbi answered, you know, there are certain people that know that God is great. And the reason why they know God is great is because God has them serving Him. Right? It's an ego trip. Look, you're so great, God. You have me serving you. You must be great. Because you got me. Right? It's an ego trip. It's an ego trip. You have to be so careful. Right? Am I in this for the having, or am I in this for the being in a relationship? If a person enters into relationship with God, then it's the acid test is responsibility. And as Buber put it, when a person stands before the eternal thou, then they see the eternal thou in every thou. Right? So we had a question. Avram runs out. He breaks from his God experience? No. He was having a God encounter. And therefore that God encounter makes him see people even more. You know, there was a Eastern teacher. I'm not critiquing the totality of this guy's works, but this is something I heard in his name. And it's not a story that jives with Judaism. His name is Abu Yandit. And I don't know much about Abu Yandit, but I do know the story. Abu Yandit was learning with a student. It was a student for 40 years. And one day, Abu Yandit turns to the student and says, what's your name? The student, this is a student for 40 years, says, Abu, I've been your student for 40 years, you forgot my name? And Abu Yandit said, once the name of the Divine has entered into my heart, I have forgotten all other names. Right? That's certainly not a Jewish story. The Zohar says that each and every one of our names is one of the names of God. That's what the Zohar says. If God's name would enter into my heart, I'd remember everybody's name. Because everybody created in the image of God, everybody is an opportunity to meet God. That spark of God in every human being is an opportunity to meet a spark of the great I Am, the great eternal you that I stand before. And so that's why the Talmud says, greater than accepting the face of God is inviting a guest into your home. That's Judaism. That's Judaism. Inviting a guest into your home is greater than accepting the face of God. And if a person has truly encountered the face of God, then they will see other people's faces much clearer. It will leave them with a sense of responsibility. It will give them greater eyesight. So it says, we notice why it said he saw. He's seeing. He's not blinded by the light of God. But the light of God does not blind the person, but the light of God lets me see what's there. I am much more sensitive to what's there. I see people, I see situations, I see the needs of the world. And I go ahead and do it. That's what happens when a person has a covenantal religion, right? I'm seeking to establish a relationship with the eternal you. I will see the eternal you reflected in every particular you I meet each day. Now, so when it says, Master, please don't pass me by, we weren't sure who he was speaking to. Was he speaking to God, or was he speaking to these people? And the answer is, it's beyond the two, right? It's both, right? Because he sees God in every person. All right, I'm going to end with one quick story. I heard a tape called The Spiritual Dance, put on by something called the Jewish Traveling Theater. It was really a panel, wasn't it? It wasn't a play. It was a panel, and it was Jews. It was a panel of Jews in quite a large auditorium for Jews. And on this panel were different types of Jews. A Buddhist Jew, a Hindu Jew, a pagan Jew, a Christian Jew, and a Jew. All right? And they were basically asking on this panel is, you know, why is it that Jews are so involved with other practices and spiritual practices? And it was kind of really ironic, funny and sad, you know, like this is what we've come to. Anyways, so on the panel was someone by the name of Richard Alpert, who is known as Ram Dass, who I met a couple months ago. And Ram Dass is a Jewish fellow who's become quite known for, you know, Eastern practices. And so they asked the people on the panel, what is it about Judaism that led you to your spiritual path? Do you understand this? I'm asking a Jew, what is it about Judaism that made you into a Buddhist? Right, or a Hindu, or a pagan. Anyway, so Ram Dass got up and said, listen, it's not what Judaism was, it was Judaism wasn't. Right? And I think I can tell you what it wasn't with one story. So I went to the East, and I came back, I went as Reuven Chaim, I came back as Ram Dass, and I was wearing pink fineries and beads. And I came to the unveiling of my mother's gravestone, and my mother was very involved with the sisterhood, my father was the president of the shul, actually called it the temple, and the rabbi was there. The rabbi was staring at me over his glasses, as rabbis will do, as he put it, and rabbi, after the speech, put out his hand and says, hey Reuven, Chaim, how you doing, what's new, what you up to? So I said to the rabbi, do you really want to know? He says, of course I want to know. So I started telling him about my experiences in the East and the meaning I had it had for me in the East. The rabbi then said, you know, Reuven, that reminds me of an experience I had. I was shocked. I'd never heard a rabbi even say such a thing. I said, rabbi, you had such an experience? You know? He says, yes, I was in seminary. I was studying for my Talmudic exam. And I was so exhausted that I dozed off. And I had a dream I was in the Holy Land. And when I was in the Holy Land, I experienced these spiritual beings that came and embraced me. And he went on and on, and he shared with me something really quite powerful. I turned to the rabbi, I said, rabbi, I'm sure you've shared that with your congregants numerous times. The rabbi said, oh no, Reuven, I would never say this in shul. You have to say, I'm a rabbi. My job is to interpret the law, not to share these kinds of experiences with people. So my friends, this is what turned me off to Judaism, right? I was looking for God, and I didn't find it in my synagogue. Alright, then they asked a couple other Jews, you know, what about Judaism led you to your path? And then they asked the panel, what is your path? How would you define your path? And this is what Reuven Chaim answers, Ram Dass answers. So when I went to the East, I was looking for the highest. I was looking for the highest form of coming close to God. And I was going to seek out the greatest gurus, greatest spiritual masters. And I researched it, and I was climbing this mountain to meet with this great master. And I met with him, and I said, holy master, what is the way? What is the highest way? And he turned to me and said, serve people. Feed people. Now, I was really disappointed. I thought, my gosh, I mean, he doesn't know how serious I am. I said to him, listen, I'm willing to fast. I'm willing to take upon myself the most rigid disciplines of meditations. Right? What is the way? And he just said to me, feed people, serve people. I was so upset. I left and I said, I'll find myself another master, because this guy, I just didn't realize how serious I am. Well, so I went and found myself another master. I went to him and I asked the master, what is the highest way? He turned to me and said, feed people, serve people. I was so upset. I said, what is this, a union? Like, what does it take to get in? But it took me a while, my friends, until I realized that the highest path to God is to serve people and to feed people. When I heard that, I was so sad. That something that was so right there in his own tradition, he was never taught. He was never taught. He had to go and become someone else in order to discover a basic Jewish idea. A basic Jewish idea. And this is the sad truth. When you look at the story, it's To me, it's one of the most beautiful stories. Here's a man who has just entered into covenant with God. He's having the most ecstatic experience anyone could dream of. It's the world to come in this world, and yet there's something greater than the world to come. It's doing good acts for another human being. That's what it says in Pirkei Avot, chapters of our fathers. It says one moment of good deeds and kindness in this world is greater than the eternity of the next world. And yet, one moment of tranquility in the next world is worth all of this world. The next world is tranquility. But this world is the opportunity to do for other people, serve people, feed people. That's the highest way to coming to God.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.